This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. For many weeks in 1973, it seemed that every TV set and radio in the country was tuned to the Senate Watergate Committee hearings, investigating the botched burglary of the headquarters of the Democratic National Committee and the cover-up by the Nixon White House. It was riveting. In June, Senator Howard Baker asked John Dean, who was legal counsel to President Nixon, one of the most memorable and significant questions.
What did the president know, and when did he know it?
Our guest, John Dean, has written a book to answer those questions titled The Nixon Defense. He listened to about 1,000 hours of scratchy tapes that Nixon had secretly recorded as he and his inner circle strategized their cover-up, which led eventually to Nixon's downfall. John Dean went to prison for his role in this political scandal. This is his third book about Nixon and Watergate. And John Dean, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
It seems after 40 years, we should have been able to answer every single question about Nixon and Watergate, and yet questions still remain. Why is that?
One of the reasons is that nobody did dig into these tapes and find out what Nixon had actually done. He put out his defense as it occurred, and there are different phases. It evolves. He writes a little bit about what he didn't report elsewhere in his memoir. But I, you know, as somebody who was involved in all this, kept thinking, you know, what's happening behind closed doors that I don't know about? Because the White House counsel is a pretty middle-level job. I know a couple judges that say they wish they'd talked to me before they left lifetime appointments to take the job.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Sounds better on paper.
It sounds better on paper. And the job's always been pretty much the same. And you wait for the president to call you. And in this instance, I didn't talk to the president until eight months after the arrest at the Watergate. So I don't know what he knows or is doing, and that's really what I tried to figure out. I started the book because I wanted to know how somebody as savvy politically as Nixon and intelligent could botch his presidency so badly over a bungled burglary.
Now, we're talking about tapes. So these were the tapes that Nixon secretly made. So these were tapes that Nixon knew about, essentially taping conversations in his...
In a number of offices, he does know about them. And one of the interesting things on the tape, you can tell at times he totally forgets that the system is voice activated. What happened is they put the system in the Oval Office. They put it in his executive office billing office. It's on a number of telephones. It's in his Camp David study. The phones in Camp David, one phone in the residence in the Lincoln City room, which the other family members did not use. It was really his sort of residence office. And in doing so, it's a fairly primitive system. They literally drilled holes in some of these historic desks that other presidents had used to put the microphones in there. And I happened to be somebody, when I went in, seemed to be sitting over a microphone every time I got in there.
So you were loud and clear, right?
I was loud and clear. No idea I was being recorded. I suspect it later, but that's later in the story. But anyway, only Haldeman and the president know that the system is there. And Haldeman is much more conscious of it, conspicuously so, than is Nixon. But basically, they don't think about it very often. So this is pretty candid stuff.
You worked with Nixon. As you said, you weren't as close to him as some people might have thought. But the Nixon that you hear on these tapes, how would you describe him? I mean, there's so many Nixons, it
seems. That's what you find on the tapes. You find a different Nixon with different people. For example, with his former, often labeled hatchet man, Chuck Colson, Chuck would bring out the darkest in him, and these would be pretty ugly conversations at times. Haldeman is not far from that. They're very candid. They're very blunt with each other. Ehrlichman is a little higher plane. With me, he's on the highest plane. It's very interesting. I learned a lot about his perception of me in doing this, because I had no idea what he thought before I went in there and when I left the meeting. And until I tell him I'm breaking rank and I'm not going to lie for anybody, I'm at the top of his list as one of his chosen few for the next administration.
You say, based on the tapes, and you've written several books about Nixon and Watergate, that he did not order the break-in at Watergate.
There's absolutely no evidence. The irony is, though, had the Watergate team under Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt and the Cuban American team that went in and got arrested in the and later prosecuted for the break-in, had they not been arrested that night, their real mission that night was to go to McGovern's headquarters. And by listening to the tapes, you can hear a tape where Nixon gives an instruction to Haldeman to place a plant, P-L-A-N-T,
right,
in the McGovern headquarters. Now, that may or may not be an electronic plant, or it may or just be a secretary or a volunteer or something like that. And so Haldeman takes that instruction from Nixon and has it passed to Liddy. And Liddy is told to change from his intelligence gathering from Muskie to McGovern. So had they not been arrested at the Watergate and gone on to do what was their mission the night they were arrested, it would have been traceable right back to the President of the United States.
Wow. But there, I mean, for instance, Ehrlichman had used the plumbers to break into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. Haldeman had thought about or even suggested breaking into the Brookings Institution.
That's Nixon. On three occasions. Actually, what happened on that, I happened to be the person that interrupted it. I didn't know that the president had ordered this. A fellow that would have been called into Chuck Colson's office by the name of Jack Caulfield, and Jack came to see me after leaving Colson's office and said, "Colson wants me to firebomb the Brookings Institute." I said, "What?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, the president thinks there's a copy of the so-called Pentagon Papers, the study done for Lyndon Johnson on the origins of the Vietnam War, in the Brookings, and the president wants doesn't he knows they won't turn them over, so he just wants somebody to go in and get them." I said, "Jack, don't do anything." I flew to California where the president was with the senior staff, got a hold of Ehrlichman and told him, I said, "John, this is insane." I said, "You know, firebomb? If somebody dies as a result of arson, it's a capital offense in the District of Columbia." And I said, "I just can't imagine doing this." He picks up the telephone, calls Colson, says, "Young counsel Dean is out here, Chuck. Doesn't think the Brookings plan's a very good one. Cancel it." He turns to me and said, "Anything else, counselor?" I said, "No, that'll take care of it this morning, John." And I went back to Washington. Later, Bud Krogh told me that a lot of people around the White House thought there was a lot of little old lady in me.
Oh.
I learned later that I was specifically not told about the plumber's operation for that very reason, that they knew that wasn't the sort of thing I believed they should be doing.
But that does tell you about Nixon, the Nixon White House, the people that worked for him, that all of this seemed perfectly okay.
The big thing that I took away in putting all these pieces together day by day to watch how he responds and dealt with it all, he's somewhat passive at the beginning, doesn't want to be told too much. Then he gets curious, and Haldeman and Ehrlichman don't tell him. They don't admit what all is going on. He doesn't know about the Ellsberg break-in, for example, which is driving much of the cover-up from the White House. That it doesn't mean he didn't get involved in the cover-up, because he approves along the way every single step of it, because Haldeman raises it. But it's after I come in later in March that he just jumps in with both feet, and then it becomes a cover-up of the cover-up, and he never lets go and takes full charge of it at that point.
But do you think there's a case of plausible deniability? I mean, maybe there's no way of knowing that he knew but didn't know.
Well, what you could do, or what one could say, is that he might have, without the taping system, have had deniability. The taping system shows he was aware of the payoffs of money very early. He's aware of the subornation, in fact, encourages the subornation of perjury of Jeb Magruder. This was all new to me. It's all new to everybody, because nobody, when I got into this project and I started cataloging these conversations to try to figure out what was there, found nobody had done so, and I at that point had to do it manually. You can do it digitally today. It'd still be very time-consuming, and discovered there's something like 1,000 Watergate conversations. I realized about 600 of those conversations nobody outside the archives has likely ever heard.
Forming the basis of the book. Let me ask you about a theory about...
It's more... I rely on all 1,000. They're the, sort of the new core of the book. But what happened also, in those 1,000, some of them had been released earlier, mm-hmm. material had been withheld. Now, because of the passing of people, the deaths had resulted in that material no longer being considered private. So I was able to fill in gaps that even earlier people had access to the tapes, couldn't get all these pieces together that, given the passage of time, I could now put those together, too.
Let me run a theory by you that I've run across. One of the reasons for the break-in at Watergate was to get to Larry O'Brien, the chairman of the Democratic Party, to get to him because of his relationship, or maybe even Nixon's relationship, with billionaire Howard Hughes. As someone who's, you know, was there and has listened to all these tapes, does any of that make sense to you?
It doesn't. In fact, I put an Appendix A in the book in which I took all of the references to why they broke into the Watergate that appear in the conversations and made a little footnote on that page and then later collected them all and sort of summarized them. And it's very clear that there's really no mystery about why they went in. It was a pure fishing expedition, trying to get some negative financial information about Larry O'Brien. Mm. They were working on another channel outside trying to audit his taxes and get his taxes done. This comes up in a number of the conversations where Nixon keeps demanding to get information about those taxes. He's convinced because... Larry O'Brien is on a retainer from Howard Hughes that he's not paying all the taxes on this, and so he's sure he'll catch him. Well, they audit, and there is no tax deficiency whatsoever. He has reported all of his income, much to the chagrin of Richard Nixon. Mm.
So who ordered the Watergate break-in?
It's pretty clear to me what happened is when Mitchell approves the plan at a third meeting with Liddy, there are two earlier meetings in his office. One, Mitchell literally laughed at the plan and thought it was absurd. I go back after that and report to Haldeman and tell him I think that there's something very amiss here. Magruder takes him back for a second meeting. I'm invited to that meeting, get in there late, and hear them talking about the same thing, and said, unfortunately, I have all this on, it's all reported on tapes today, we know. I come back in and say, listen, this isn't something that should ever be talked about even in the Office of the Attorney General of the United States. I was offended by it. I wanted to get Mitchell off the hook, and I wanted to get as far away from it as possible as I could. I again now know, I had originally thought I had just come to Haldeman after the second meeting, but the record shows I went after both meetings and told him this was craziness that was going on. But there's a third meeting, and this is done in Florida when Mitchell is down there, and he approves it, and he approves a break-in in the Watergate, and that's where the approval came from.
And he was Attorney General of the United
States? No, he'd left then.
He'd already left.
Just right after he leaves.
Let me take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's John Dean, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's got a new book. It's called The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Here's how to be a good contestant on Ask Me Another, NPR's hour of puzzles, word games, and trivia. Tip one, if you don't know the answer, guess.
Driving Michael Phelps.
Could I say right now that I would totally watch the TV show Driving Michael Phelps?
Remember what show you're on.
That is correct. We're not on Jeopardy, but you're right.
Tune in and shout out answers every week on Ask Me Another.
Saturday nights at 8, beginning August 2nd on WHYY.
Are Japanese beetles ravaging your roses and gorging on your grapevines? I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how a listener used some Garden State attitude to beat the beetles. Plus answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. and noon, right here on WHYY-FM.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It was August 1st, 1966. The first mass shooting on a U.S. campus happened in Austin, Texas.
His shooting range was 5 city blocks, and so, you know, over 500 yards, I mean, he was able to kill people.
A new novel imagines what it was like for the victims. Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. If you have any questions about the Watergate break-in, about the cover-up at the White House, about Richard Nixon, this is the place to call. Our guest is John Dean, again, author of a new book called The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, based on his listening and transcription of really hours and hours of some of Nixon's secret recordings. And you can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.com. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. You mentioned G. Gordon Liddy. I mean, what a character. This is a guy that talked about kidnappings and using prostitutes and break-ins and drugging people.
Liddy has always sort of portrayed himself as some sort of James Bond character. When you look at the historical record, he's just not quite up to the Maxwell Smart level.
Really?
No. He is a total bungler. This is all ham-handed stuff. I'm actually responsible in part for him going over there because my office as White House counsel was doing too much work of the re-election committee in the early days, the election law material. And so Haldeman tells me, you've got to get somebody over there as general counsel who you can rely on and what have you. Well, there was a guy on the White House staff by the name of David Young, who he and I had traveled around the country vetting potential Supreme Court nominees. Mm-hmm. And I got to know David. He's very bright, and I thought, this is perfect. He'd be a wonderful general counsel. Went to his sort of his partner at the White House, Bud Krogh, and I said, I'd like to suggest that David go over and be general counsel. He said, David can't do it. He's on a very high secret project. This was to track, he was tracking leaks, and they had a very serious leak problem, and this one would be one of the most serious. They actually had a spy in Henry Kissinger's National Security Council. It's all come out now. It was digging into Kissinger's suitcase at night and pulling things out. So anyway, David was not available, but Bud said, listen, I have a perfect guy. Do you know Gordon Liddy? I said, I don't know Liddy. He said, well, he's a former FBI agent. He's a good lawyer, former prosecutor. He knows John Mitchell, who's going to be the head of the campaign. I'd suggest him. So I take Liddy over to be interviewed by Mitchell. Mitchell likes him. And what I didn't know at the time is that Ehrlichman and Krogh were trying to get Liddy out of the White House because he had had this bungled burglary at Ellsberg's psychiatrist. So rather than reprimand him and tell him this isn't, you know, the way we do things here, they escalate him. They give him a better job. So he goes over there with the thought that, you know, I've got to come up with even grander plans because these obviously are the things that these people want.
So how soon did Nixon know about the break-in, and how soon would you say the cover-up began?
Cover-up begins instantly. It operates on different channels. Nixon is in Florida at the time and spends the weekend down there that the men are arrested in the Watergate. He learns from the Miami newspaper, sees a small clip about the fact that Cuban Americans from Miami have been arrested in the Democratic National Committee, and they've been caught in surgical gloves and with $100 bills in their pocket, and he thinks it's a prank. You know, he doesn't understand it, knows nothing about it. He also, when he learns from Colson over that weekend that James McCord of the Re-Election Committee was involved and arrested also, he's angry. He throws an ashtray across the room. He tells Colson this, and he is wise enough, though, to walk that reaction back and make it disappear. So, but he doesn't really know, and he's not involved. Haldeman and Ehrlichman, however, get word right away from Jeb Magruder, who's in California with Mitchell. Liddy has called him and told him of the disaster, the fact that he's used somebody like James McCord, who was the chief of security of the Re-Election Committee. So they immediately approve a bogus press release that says we have nothing to do with this, we have no knowledge of it, has no place in the electoral process. So the cover-up starts from that moment, from that first press release.
And as you listen to then Nixon talking to people about the cover-up and how they're going to handle these various investigations, is this a man that seems so foreign to you as someone who had dealt with him on a more sort of one-on-one basis? As you say, he treated you rather well.
Yes. His inclination, his first reaction is he's worried that John Mitchell is involved in this. And it was something he obviously would have good reason to worry about. And, you know, I think Mitchell, had he not have had a debriefing of Liddy through some of his staff, might have stepped forward and say, listen, I wasn't watching the store. This isn't exactly what I had in mind. I did want some political intelligence. This got out of hand. I'm going to accept responsibility for it. End of story. The reason that doesn't happen is that two of his aides, Fred LaRue and Bob Mardian, interview Liddy at length and want to know what all's going on. And Liddy tells them what he will also tell me is that two of the men who were in the D.C. jail, he'd used in the Ellsberg break-in at the request of the White House. So Mitchell immediately realizes that's even more serious than this bungled Watergate operation. And that's when I see in his behavior in those first days, and I'm not in the room in these, but I through Haldeman's diary, through what's repeated by Haldeman in conversations with Nixon, it becomes clear that the cover-up in Mitchell just dives right in. One day he is told the White House, don't get involved in this at all. 24 hours later, after being told of Liddy's other activities, Liddy and Howard Hunt's, he thinks the White House has got to be involved and try to get the FBI to back off and all these things. So the three of them form the initial conspiracy to cover up. And I'm only brought in later as sort of a desk officer. Their personalities develop here, too. With Mitchell convinced it's Ehrlichman's fault for sending Liddy over there and having him do these absurd things at the White House, which are terribly serious. And Ehrlichman thinks it's all Mitchell's fault for letting Liddy authorizing some sort of plan to break in the DNC. So these two guys who never got along to start with. In fact, I have some conversations where Nixon is finally asking them about this breach between them because it's been longstanding. And so it does surface, and Nixon is aware of it. But these personalities play into who does what. And because I'm on good terms and can communicate with both men, I sort of become the link between them.
Well, you also say, and this is about Nixon, that he had a special, I'm quoting here, special tolerance for using unethical means for partisan purposes and to bend the law to his own political advantage. So, I mean, looking at this sort of in hindsight, but also looking at through these tapes, that's the Nixon, at least that I read in your book.
That's the man who surfaces in these tapes. You know, I think we've gotten as close to the real Nixon. It's a combination of his character, which I think those words describe it, and his decision-making. That was the most startling thing. This man, and I think other scholars now have to look at other areas of his presidency to say, you know, if he made his decisions as he did here, so, you know, seat of the pants, no information, ignoring real facts.
And contradicting himself, it seems a lot.
Exactly. What else did he do in other areas of his presidency where we thought this was a very competent executive that knew how to carefully look at both sides of an issue before he came down and made a decision? We used to do decision papers at the White House. I'm wondering if those were ever even considered now after reading and getting into this process in Watergate.
But could it be argued that he knew he was in trouble and therefore in a state of panic and frankly wasn't thinking straight?
That could be a factor. But he also was having similar problems with the Congress and other areas, cutting off his money for Vietnam, some of his decisions on impounding funds, and some of it was very visceral. So I think it raises bigger questions. And It certainly was the disaster that produces Watergate.
Let me reintroduce you. That's John Dean, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's got a new book called The Nixon Defense, and it's subtitled What He Knew and When He Knew It, a very famous statement or question, I should say, from the ranking Republican Howard Baker on the Senate committee investigating the Watergate scandal, asking John Dean that question back in the summer of 1973. And again, we're taking calls. Any questions or comments? That phone number 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. I do want to play just a section where you're testifying before the Watergate hearings in June of 1973, talking about the cancer on the White House. Another very famous comment that came out from those hearings. Let's listen.
I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it. I also told him that it was important that this cancer be removed immediately because it was growing more deadly every day.
And you include here in the book, you're telling the president that.
I do indeed. What's interesting, you know, it was comparing, I didn't do a lot of this, but just sometimes I would check my testimony to see how accurate it was. And what my testimony, and I found my memory, I conflated events that happened very quickly. I couldn't separate days. Our memories aren't time-stamped. That was the most difficult thing. I could remember the gist of what had happened. But, for example, on the March 21st conversation today, I know it's a 76-page transcript. It's single-spaced, very small margins. It's an hour and 40-minute conversation.
You and the president.
Haldeman comes in for the last 40 minutes.
Right.
But it's basically the first hour is the president and myself, where I am taking him through every conceivable problem to make sure he understands. I, at that point, didn't know how much he knew. Today, I now know he knew so much more than he let on and that I thought he knew. But I thought he needed to understand the criminal implications of these things, and I'm not sure he did fully understand those until I finished. And because I used blunt words like, we're obstructing justice if we pay Hunt the money he's now demanding. The people are committing perjury. I had no idea that he had been busy suborning perjury himself. That's the only way the initial stage of that cover-up would have worked. So this was, in fact, he has an interesting reaction I found in his diary after I left. There are a number of kind of long sighs I make on the conversation, and they're just utter frustration because I'm trying to convince this man that he's got to end it, and only he can end this cover-up. But I'm not able to carry the day. And he just says, well, you know, maybe we have to continue doing this and what have you. At one point I say, for example, you know, these guys are going to keep demanding more and more money. And he says, well, John, how much could it cost? Mm. And I pulled out right out of thin air what I thought was a hefty number. I said, this could cost $1 million over the next couple of years. And what's that, $5.5 million today? So that's serious money. So his reaction? That's no problem, John. I know where we can get $1 million. And also interesting, I was curious what happened after this conversation. He calls Rose Woods in and says to Rose, how much do we have in our slush fund that only they know about? And they've got about $400,000 in the slush fund. I also know today, before that conversation, he was selling an ambassadorship.
I wanted to ask you about that.
He was selling an ambassadorship to raise money. For the Watergate defendants.
And this was the ambassadorship to Greece.
To Greece, exactly. A man by the name of Tom Pappas. That had gotten very difficult. Haldeman comes in on March 2nd and tells the president a little background that Mitchell's having trouble raising money to pay the defendants in cash, and he's got Fred LaRue running around, and no, and that's a bad idea. And he says, but Mitchell's found somebody who will help us on this, and that's Tom Pappas, who is a longtime Nixon supporter. He's been connected with the Finance Committee. He was Eisenhower's ambassador to Greece. He had recently sold a company he owned in Greece and had, Haldeman says, a great deal of cash, which Nixon says, good. And that's what was needed. And so Nixon has a private dinner on March 6th for the heavy hitters, the big contributors. And Pappas spots him at this event and says, "Mr. President, I need to talk to you." And Nixon sends word immediately to set up a meeting for the next morning. Tells Haldeman about the meeting, said, "I'm having Pappas in." I remember somebody saying he was raising money, and Haldeman repeats the whole thing. And if there's any doubt about a quid pro quo here, Haldeman says, "You can get your chit out of this by reminding him how difficult this is," because they had planned to move the ambassador that was there, a fellow named Henry Tosca, out of Greece to another post or out of the Foreign Service or whatever. And that's who Pappas wants. So Haldeman says, "Well, you know, you just tell him that we'll work on it." And obviously his good efforts in helping raise this money are clearly the quid pro quo. Mm. He calls, when Pappas comes in the next morning, when I originally wrote it, I said, "This is like a scene from The Godfather." But then my editor said, "John," he said, "you've been so good in this book of not offering commentary or not being pejorative and setting a scene." But it just struck me because I listened to this tape. Pappas has a very husky, whispery kind of voice, and Nixon is very kind of conspiratorial in this little segment as they talk, and he thanks him. He said, "Not many guys will do this sort of thing for somebody, and why are you doing it, Tom?" And Tom just says, "Well, I can do it." And so that you have this bizarre exchange. And but it's also ironic for this reason: Nixon, after he is pardoned, will be called before a grand jury, a Watergate special prosecution grand jury, for which he has no immunity from perjury. Had the Watergate prosecutors found these transcripts I found, Richard Nixon probably would have been prosecuted.
For
perjury.
Why didn't he destroy the tapes? I mean, when all this began to fall apart around him.
There are two. I have conversations in the book in April. It comes up a couple times where he and Haldeman talk about the taping system and, you know, its quality and how it's working, right, and the fact that it'll never be available to anybody and what have you. But in April, Nixon on two occasions instructs Haldeman to remove the system. He actually says, "I'm uncomfortable recording people," but he doesn't stop doing it. And Haldeman says, "Sure, I'll take care of it," and he never does. And I think the explanation of that is that Haldeman himself then, about that time, got so consumed by Watergate himself, he just didn't think about it. And I think Haldeman also thought, he wasn't a lawyer, thought Nixon might be able to use some of this selectively by clipping out what sounded good and making the rest disappear. So the system is never removed. Even when Al Haig comes in as White House Chief of Staff, they don't tell him about the system. And I quote Haig in there as saying, you know, even he, who had almost nothing bad to say about Richard Nixon, he was a, you know, click his heels, salute, and yes, sir, and let's get it done. He thinks it's insane that Nixon didn't have some control over this system, that was voice activated, and everything in the room that was said was recorded.
And became inevitably his downfall. Let me reintroduce you. We're going to take a very short break. That's John Dean, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, talking about Nixon and his new book called The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It, based on listening to many, many hours of secret recordings. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Much more after this very short break, including those 18 and a half minutes. We'll be right back.
Next time on The Pulse, we'll be at the beach. We'll attend a therapy session on surfboards.
I am basically living my dream, bro.
We'll find out how climate change is affecting beach communities.
Right where we are in 2050, we'll be underwater twice a month.
We'll avoid getting sunburned.
Reapply, reapply, reapply.
And we'll learn how to play frisbee with a scientific approach, of course.
If the air is being pushed downwards, the air is pushing upwards.
Tomorrow morning at 9 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times foreign correspondent Rukmini Kalamaki about her investigation into Al-Qaeda's lucrative business of kidnapping for ransom. And we'll talk about the trove of Al-Qaeda documents she discovered in North Mali, documents left behind by the jihadists when they fled, and what they reveal about Al-Qaeda's operations. Join us. this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
If you're like most people, you rely on a wide variety of sources for the news of the day. I'm John Hockenberry, and on The Takeaway, we draw on our partners, the New York Times, the WGBH Boston Public Radio folks, and experts from around the country, so you can better understand your world. Listen to all the sources each weekday on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. Believe it or not, 40 years ago this summer, President Richard Nixon resigned from office. He had refused to hand over White House tapes concerning the Watergate break-in and cover-up. And again, our guest John Dean, former White House legal counsel to President Nixon, listened to hundreds of hours of Nixon's secret recordings for his new book called The Nixon Defense, What He Knew and When He Knew It. Dean says Nixon did not order the break-in, but was very much a part of the cover-up. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. There are, of course, many rumors that have floated around about this case. And of course, one of the great mysteries is this 18 and a half minutes gap on this tape. On the dates, June 20th, 1972, many theories, much conspiracy about what was on the tape and who erased it. What are your conclusions?
Well, because of the fact that there is that mystery, I decided to do a special appendix on it, which I did. And having listened to not just hundreds of hours, I listened to every Watergate conversation, every time the subject came up or related subject came up. So I really have the entire picture.
In your head, right?
Most of it reduced into that book. I'm not sure which was harder, was transcribing them or turning around and reducing them back to narrative and dialogue. It was a toss-up. They were both tough. But anyway, so I've got the whole story there. And in the process, I said, well, you know, there is such media interest, and as a result of that, there's public interest in this 18-and-a-half-minute gap. I'm able, and I put this because I don't think it's worth more than a footnote, are the five people who might have done it. A couple of them are still alive. To me, it's much more important not who did it, but what would have been erased. And that becomes very clear when you understand this big picture. On Nixon's final defense is that he knew nothing about Watergate until I came in on March 21st and told him. That isn't true. We know that isn't true. I know it's not true in countless conversations. But it first arises when the Watergate prosecutor subpoenas a conversation on June 20th, his first recorded conversation with Haldeman after the arrest. He's come back from Florida, and so this they had probable cause to be logical they would be talking about Watergate. We know from Haldeman's notes they did talk about Watergate. So what were they talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
There's no mystery. There's no mystery at all. They're talking about a cover-up, because all he had to do is have any inference, implication, or indication that he's involved in a cover-up, and he blows away his own last defense. That's what happens when the so-called smoking gun tape recurs 3 days later on a Friday, the 23rd, and here clearly that he's very actively telling Haldeman to use the CIA to block the FBI. That's cover-up. Well, there's lots of cover-up discussion that week when they first came back. It just happens to be that the only tape that was, or conversation that was subpoenaed, that they had probable cause, was June 20th. So whoever did do it, the reason he did it is because it would blow away his final firewall defense. It's not that there was some great secret we don't know. In fact, in the totality of things, I don't think it's going to, you know, if they ever could recover that conversation, it won't begin to shed the light that many other conversations we now have do on Nixon's behavior in this. So that's the only thing it could have been, because there's just nothing else in the range of these hundreds of conversations that would justify it being erased.
But he does, by whoever erased it, Nixon makes Rosemary Wood part of the cover-up.
Well, and the other thing I found out is that Rosemary Woods, as she believe she had erased it and went to court and explained that. She didn't think she had done 18 minutes, 18 and a half minutes. She thought she'd done like five. Al Haig, the chief of staff, said, well, you know, women get confused about time.
That was a time and place, yes.
Which didn't endear him to the hearts of American women,
not
who probably are much better than men at keeping track of time. But anyway, the way Rose explained doing it, in the way she pushed the button on this machine, well, only recently a friend of mine found one of the few engineers in this country who serviced that machine. It was an imported machine. It was a Ure machine. It was a German machine. And he explained that it is humanly impossible to erase a conversation in any of the ways that Rosemary Woods explained it. So you can only draw one conclusion. It wasn't Rose that did it. It was somebody else. And there were 5 to 9 efforts to do it before they finally got it all erased. You can tell that because the impressions it made on the analog tape that was passing through the over the tape heads, and so that's how they determined that it had been erased. But the Rose talking about, well, I pressed my foot pedal and I also pressed the record button at the same time. All of those are mechanically impossible. In fact, it takes two hands on the buttons almost simultaneously, and very few women can do it even with one hand. They can't get the leverage. They can't get the spread.
Do you think it was Nixon?
He would be a very strong possibility, but he's so mechanically inept. I think I know who it is. I just haven't named the person because he's still alive.
Oh, very interesting.
But again, what difference does it make who did it? I think it's what was done and why it would have been done, and I think that's very clear. When you see this marshaled in my appendix, you'll understand there's just no place else to go with this.
Let me get to, looks like Julie from Bala Cynwyd to join our conversation. Hi, Julie. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Dean, I'd like to know if the name Sam Dash comes into your book. You know, he's a native Philadelphian who graduated from the great Central High School here in the city. Does that name come into your book?
It sure does.
Thanks, Julie. On
a number of occasions. In fact, I was very friendly with Sam both before Watergate and after, and knew and respected him as a lawyer and as just a person. So, he weaves throughout the story after the Senate Watergate Committee begins its selection process of who it's going to hire as its chief counsel. And then Sam and I, when I realize the prosecutors can't handle this case, and Sam realizes he's got a problem with some of the members of this committee who can't keep their mouth closed, other than Sam Ervin, that they arrange to have secret meetings with me because my lawyer and I decide this is the only place this case is going to be resolved is by getting the information public, and not a grand jury will really not solve the problem because the public won't have a clue. That's all a secret proceeding. So, yes, you'll find Sam running throughout the book.
And do you like the gates that have been attached to various political scandals or even near scandals? There's even talk now about impeaching Obama or somebody
suing the
president.
You know why the gates got attached is because Bill Safire, who had been a Nixon speechwriter, started putting the gates on. And he did that in a very effective way to try to make Watergate less of a significant event. But if you hang this gate on just the most minor types of scandals, suddenly Watergate is no big deal. And so he succeeded at this. Yeah, the suffix has added to things that just don't deserve or come anywhere close to the conduct that was involved in Watergate. And the book also makes clear that it was more than a bungled burglary and a cover-up. And this what happens is the Post very effectively, and they're the only newspaper covering it, they meld other Nixon behavior, his efforts to influence the campaign with dirty tricks, they now today are considered under any definition of Watergate as part of Watergate. So it's so much more than just the burglary and the cover-up.
I mean, it really is about the abuse of power.
That is, it is typically defined as the abuse of power for political purposes occurring during the presidency of Richard Nixon. That's kind of a typical dictionary definition.
And Nixon really truly believed that he could keep those tapes to himself?
He really does. This taping system ends when Alex Butterfield reveals it. It's clear, and I track some of this, and I sort of summarize that in a chronology at the end to just wrap it up, because this book is basically takes the reader inside the White House via the recordings. But it's clear he gets opinions from a very eminent lawyer who said the court can't get this. This is your material. It's yours forever, and to do as you wish with.
Even though he's president and it's in the White House?
Right. Well, the Charlie Wright, who wrote this opinion, later had to eat a little crow on that ruling.
What about Mrs. Mitchell, Martha Mitchell? And she, you know, was such a character, in many ways sort of a tragic character, I think, in this story.
She is. And I knew and liked Martha. And I was somewhat surprised at the rather candid discussions that came up in the tapes about Martha Mitchell. So she weaves through the story very early, and Nixon feels in many of the conversations that Watergate occurred because of Martha, because the trouble that John Mitchell was having with her, that he wasn't minding the store. And so he wants to lay this off on her. But it also becomes clear that that John Mitchell and Martha make an agreement that he will get out of politics. Watergate just is the catalyst that sort of expedites it all. And so that story is fairly fully reported in the pages of this book.
You thought Deep Throat was Al Haig.
Initially, yes, I did.
Initially, yeah. And it turned out to be Mark Felt.
Well, I have a wonderful story in the book that we knew all about Mark Felt and being a leaker. We didn't know about a character called Deep Throat.
Yeah.
And the reason I never, and I was well aware of that fact, I remember reporting that I had been told by the head of the criminal division that Mark Felt, who's the number two man in the FBI, is leaking like a sieve because a lawyer for one of the publications to whom he was leaking came in to tell the head of the criminal division, "I'm concerned. This might be grand jury information. We don't want to get involved in an obstruction of justice," and so on and so forth. And when Peterson tells me this, he says, "I haven't told the attorney general, haven't told the deputy attorney general, haven't told the head of the FBI, Pat Gray, because I'm afraid they will do something that'll cause Felt to just go off the top and it'll even be worse." So I said, "I'm not quite sure how to handle this, but I think I should tell you so the White House knows this." Well, I take this back to Haldeman, and he reports it to the president. In fact, one of the interesting things is how the fact that when I was able to digitize this material, I can hear more in my digital editions, because the first person to deal with this conversation, where I have reported back and then it's being reported into the president via Haldeman, at one point the transcriber, it was in Stanley Cutler's book of transcripts on some of these, and he reports it as Nixon saying to Haldeman, "You know what I would do with Felt, Bob?" And then there's an expletive.
Yeah, of course.
what follows. But I hear something, and everybody else now that listens to my transcript of that hears what I heard, because sometimes you just need a little guidance on this. What he says is, "You know what I would do with Felt, Bob? Ambassadorship." And that's what he later does with Helms. He appoints him an ambassador and moves him out. The reason that clearly Felt is leaking is, and there's a wonderful book out on this called Leak by Max Holland, who I worked with closely and actually shared some of my tapes and what have you. He wants the job of director of the FBI and thinks by embarrassing the acting director, Pat Gray, that he'll get the job.
You know, I lived through some of this as an outsider, just, you know, a young person in the 1970s, and reading through this and all the other books that have been written about Watergate and Nixon. On the one hand, it's extraordinary that all of this was going on, this abuse of power, the sort of Mickey Mouse-ness of it all as well. And on the other hand, you know, the country kind of survived it all as well.
Well, it did. And one of the things that always surprised me when I was working on this day after day is how little attention Nixon is paying to the rest of the presidency. He gets consumed by this as time goes on. And it kind of says that the presidency can almost operate without a president at times.
Oh, that's interesting.
That enough of an institution in the White House and the cabinet and what have you that it can function. And I'm sure, well, you can go back to Woodrow Wilson and, sure, and see that sort of thing as well, when he was totally incapacitated. So the system is stronger, but it's also a fragile system, and it's so susceptible to abuse. And a president who abuses those powers, when we talk about, you know, impeachment today and impeaching Obama, I've thought I should get a copy of this to every Republican in the House of Representatives so they can really see what misbehavior is in a presidency.
Are you done with Nixon? This is, what, your third book?
This is my third book.
Are you done with him?
I hope so.
Done with this period in your life?
Actually, there's been a suggestion.
There's more?
there's been a suggestion that I would be the person to take on some of these conspiracy theorists and blow those apart that have cooked up some of these crazy theories about Watergate, which just don't bear up, particularly now that I have 1,000 conversations. They fill 21 notebooks. 3-inch notebooks, about 8,500 pages of this stuff. One of my critics on this book said, why don't you publish them all? Most people don't want 4 million words. And that's about what it is.
Is that what it is?
Of Nixon on Watergate.
But I think a book about dealing with conspiracy theories on Watergate would be a very good book
to do. Well, that's been suggested. I haven't. I'm OD'd in it right now, so it won't be the next book.
John Dean, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio
thank
Times.
You.
You're welcome. And the book is called The Nixon Defense, and it's subtitled What He Knew and When He Knew It. And John Dean was legal counsel to President Nixon during this scandal-ridden period of our country's history. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can download podcasts of our interviews. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and much, much more. Bob Ball is the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.